Hi, Marco Werman here. Thank you for making the world part of your world by tuning into the show every day. We are grateful for your support. This year, the holiday season looks a lot different. Here at The World, we know what it's like to feel out of touch and uncertain about the future. That's why we strive to bring you honest stories that connect you with people around the globe. One thing you can be certain of is that The World team is dedicated to bringing you the coverage you need. Right now, though, The World needs you. Specifically, 578 dedicated listeners to donate $100 each to reach our goal. That's just $8.33 a month to support the stories we bring you each day. You can make your donation at theworld.org/give. When we make the goal, and I know you'll get us there, I'll host a virtual celebration with the World team and send you an invite as a thank you for your support. Right now, go to theworld.org/give, and from everybody here at The World, thanks very much. Mexico has been hit hard by the pandemic. Doctors there are burning out.
We are really tired of treating patients with COVID nonstop.
Also today, when an Iranian scientist is assassinated, they leave behind a widow, someone who's left only with memories.
A young wife, a young mother who writes how much she misses her husband.
And an oratorio in 11 movements about the history of aviation.
And it's told using the words of the great pilots, inventors, engineers, poets, and storytellers that actually pushed this narrative forward across the centuries.
The spirit of Da Vinci, Copernicus, and Amelia Earhart set to classical music. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be with you. The shocking pandemic number today, 1.5 million. That's about the number of people who've died from COVID-19 worldwide. And public health officials are warning us to brace for a winter when that number could climb dramatically. Mexico ranks fourth in confirmed deaths from COVID, behind the U.S., Brazil, and India. The head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus, said yesterday that Mexico was in bad shape and that the rise in cases and deaths was very worrying. As in many places, the coronavirus has had a serious impact on Mexico's medical personnel. Shannon Young has more on that from the Mexican state of Oaxaca.
Mexico never got its first wave of COVID fully under control, and cases are once again surging after months of stagnation. Healthcare workers here haven't had much of a break. Among them is Dr. Lorena Guerrero, an infectious disease fellow at the National Institute of Health Sciences and Nutrition, one of Mexico's top hospitals.
We are really tired. All the healthcare professionals are really tired of treating patients with COVID nonstop.
Beyond the exhaustion, medical professionals are also getting sick. Government data shows the virus has killed more than 2,000 Mexican healthcare workers since March. Guerrero co-authored a research paper on COVID mortality among medical workers in Mexico City and found many reasons for the deaths. Among them were high rates of comorbidities, not enough access to personal protective equipment, and inadequate testing to detect cases.
Hemos usado una palabra que es inconmensurable. Inconmensurable.
Deputy Health Secretary Dr. Hugo López-Gatell leads Mexico's COVID task force. He's repeatedly dismissed the need for mass testing, arguing the pandemic is immeasurable. The task force has used a methodology called sentinel surveillance, which restricts outpatient testing to a small sample of people who report to clinics with COVID-like symptoms. López-Gatell argues that results from these samples reveal the dimensions of the larger outbreak without using the resources needed to mass test. But sparse testing means sparse knowledge of who is actually infected with the coronavirus, and that can lead to uncontrolled spread. Dr. Guerrero, the infectious disease fellow, says low testing has been especially dangerous for healthcare workers who have limited access to PPE.
Only when they were treating patients with COVID, diagnosed with COVID, they used the protection. So if you didn't think that you were treating a patient with COVID, you didn't get the equipment. And that's a problem because sometimes you don't know who has COVID and who doesn't until they have symptoms.
Guerrero says the hospital where she works has ample supplies of PPE and access to tests with quick results thanks to an on-site lab. But that's not the case at many smaller hospitals, particularly those where COVID patients and people with more routine problems receive treatment in the same building. A September report by Amnesty International showed Mexico led the world in the known number of healthcare workers lost to the virus. Since then, deaths among medical professionals here have increased by an average of nearly 8 per day.
Aquí es importante hacer una precisión y que en su momento también.
At a recent press conference, Mexico's chief epidemiologist, Dr. José Luis Alomía, defended the government's management of the pandemic. He suggests official data on healthcare worker deaths may paint an exaggerated picture of workplace risks. Months ago, the government offered paid protective leave to public sector healthcare workers in high-risk categories. But not all medical personnel on leave from public hospitals stay home. Guerrero points out that it's common for physicians in Mexico to maintain private practices.
So you cannot say entirely that they are at their house or at their home without risk. They are probably, or they could be, working with COVID patients in other institutions.
Several healthcare workers here in Oaxaca spoke off the record due to concerns of professional reprisals. They say hospital-issued protective gear is sometimes substandard, and they often have to spend their own money for N95 masks, face shields, and even hand sanitizer. A couple of hospital staffers said colleagues who were supposed to be on protective leave are sometimes called in to cover shifts when staffing is short. In light of the challenges facing healthcare workers, volunteers are stepping in to help. Josue Martinez is with a brigade of volunteer paramedics known as Brigadas Arvu.
El número que nos corrió a nosotros es el 911.
The group has an ambulance, and Martina says they coordinate with Oaxaca's 911 emergency dispatch service. They're mostly active on weekends, he says, to help respond to more routine medical emergencies and administer first aid. This frees up professional paramedics to handle more complicated cases, like transporting COVID patients. During their downtime, the volunteers ask for spare change donations at traffic lights to cover the costs of first aid materials and gas for the ambulance. Others help out by volunteering from home. Arturo Erderly is a mathematician and statistics professor at Mexico's National University, UNAM. Every night he compiles, updates, and tweets easy-to-read graphs based on data released by the Federal Health Secretariat. His hashtag means I have other graphs, and he's become a trusted data analyst for healthcare workers, journalists, and his Twitter followers. But halting Mexico's spiraling crisis requires more than volunteerism. Frontline healthcare workers like Dr. Lorena Guerrero say Mexico needs to overhaul its national COVID response strategy.
First thing I would say is to test, increase the numbers of tests everywhere, at schools, at work, at the hospitals. Second recommendation would be to be sure that everyone knows how to use their face masks.
After months of grueling work and loss, it's clear the best way to help healthcare workers is to change the conditions that are making them sick. But lightening that load isn't up to them. It's a social contract that will require large-scale institutional effort, political will, and disciplined participation from the general public. For The World, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico.
When a bystander shot a video of police officers beating Rodney King in Los Angeles in 1991, the footage shocked the world. Back then, cell phones with cameras were not a thing. Today, everyone understands the power of bystander videos. That's why many French citizens are angry with their government, as it considers taking away the right to film or photograph police when they're in action. The proposed legislation sparked massive protests in France this weekend. Now the French government is backing off. But activists like Rokhaya Diallo are worried that their government might try again. Diallo is a French journalist, author, filmmaker, and anti-racism activist.
We in France and around the world, we understood how important it was for, you know, police to be accountable. And to be accountable, we need to make sure that we have a way to report on how they work.
So is the government reversal on this bill a victory for anti-racism activists like you in France?
It's not really a victory because they are saying that it will be rewritten and that it may be put in another bill that is meant to fight terrorism. So, you know, people are quite confused because the bill has already been adopted in the National Assembly and it's supposed to be discussed in January, but we don't know how it will be rewritten and we don't know if that specific provision will not appear in another law. So that's the concern of the people. And, you know, we're happy to see that the government had to take into account the fact that so many dozens of thousands of people went in the streets to protest, so they had to do something. But I'm not sure it's enough because the law is still there. And the other thing is that according to the law, the police would be able to be authorized to use drone to deploy drones using facial recognition to monitor protests. So it's a very important threat to our civil liberties because when you protest, you're not supposed to be filmed and to have your face recorded in the police records.
I mean, perhaps Emmanuel Macron has a point. I mean, he has said that France is under attack, referring to recent events with attackers wielding knives and decapitations. I mean, even the protests this weekend, people were burning cars. The police do seem to be on the front lines. Don't they need some kind of protection?
I don't know how, you know, not having the right to document the police activity would prevent terrorism and terror attacks. I think it has nothing to do with that. The thing is that last week we had just two videos documenting the fact that police were very brutal to people in the streets. The first one was police group clearing a migrant camp in the middle of Paris and beating them and beating also a journalist who was there to cover the clearing. Another document went viral on social media of a black music producer who was just not wearing his mask and who was brutally assaulted by three police officers. If it wasn't for the videos, that man would be in jail because the police made fake declarations on what he did. They said that the black man assaulted them, which was not true, and which we couldn't have found out if it wasn't for the videos.
So the police say they need protection from being made public. Citizens say they need accountability from police abuse. Let me ask you this. Are the proposed laws' limits on freedom of expression your main concern, Rokhaya, about the legislation, or are you concerned about other parts of the bill as well?
I'm concerned also about the surveillance part, the fact that it gives ubiquitous surveillance system. And some lawyers are very concerned about the fact that that law may transform our social model and maybe push France further to a police state. And it's something that gives good reason to worry because it gives much power to the national police, but also to the local police, which doesn't have the same training as the national police. So they would have expanded rights to monitor the crowds in the streets. And it doesn't sound good for civil liberties.
If this bill goes through or some form of it, what would that signal to communities of color across France that have long had an antagonistic relationship with French police?
The thing is that France has been sentenced several times for police brutality, for racism in the police by its own Supreme Court, but also by the European Court of Human Rights, and also the United Nations have warned France because of that. And nothing has been done. There hasn't been any political response. So having no response on that and having a new bill controlling very strictly the freedom of expression just gives the signal that racism in the police doesn't matter, but that we need to control the freedom of expression of the regular citizens.
You nodded to this, Rokhaya. France seems to be at a critical juncture. Some say it's drifting closer to authoritarianism. So what can activists and others do at this moment to push for kind of re-envisioning the role of police and also what race is in French society?
I think that what activists did during the past weeks, protesting in the streets and raising awareness around the world, worked well. And I think that they shouldn't leave the pressure. The pressure works quite well, especially because we have a president who is very cautious on his public image in the media abroad. So it's a very critical year because we've been able to force the media and force the politicians to tackle police brutality, especially after the tragic death of George Floyd. We had to, like the activists and journalists who are committed to social justice, really push the media, push the narrative in order to make France face its problems with race and its history, its colonial history, its slave history. So I think we are at a turning point regarding that specific issue.
Rokhaya Diallo, French journalist, author, filmmaker, and anti-racism activist, speaking with us from Paris. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, one of the world's largest telescopes is no more. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. The holidays mean big business for the chocolate industry, but a case before the U.S. Supreme Court today raises difficult questions about where exactly that chocolate comes from and what was involved in making it. The case centers around six people. They say they were trafficked from the West African nation of Mali as children and forced to work on cocoa farms in neighboring Côte d'Ivoire. The case is about whether lawsuits filed against chocolate companies, Nestle and Cargill, can move forward. Joining us now to discuss this is Martina Vandenberg. She's the president of the Human Trafficking Legal Center. Martina, what else can you tell us about the case and the people at the center of it, these six people who say they were trafficked as children? How old are they now and where do they live?
The children are now adults. This case was actually filed in 2005, and so it's been pending for years, bouncing up and down between the courts and the courts of appeals. But the fundamental violations of human rights that these children in 2005 pled horrify people, and today it was obvious that they horrified the court as well. These are children who allege that they were taken, they were trafficked from Mali to Côte d'Ivoire, and that they were held in slavery, harvesting cocoa that ends up in U.S. supply chains.
It's been established that forced labor is fairly rampant in the chocolate industry, but how far afield does that reach? I mean, if you buy a chocolate bar from the grocery store, is it likely that there's child labor behind it?
Sadly, yes. And it's likely actually that there could be child forced labor or child slavery behind it. It is not the unusual circumstance to find child labor or child forced labor in supply chains. The entire system needs to be completely redesigned from the ground up to make sure that these human rights violations don't occur.
The legal case in front of the Supreme Court rests on a statute that goes back to 1789 called the Alien Tort Statute. It raises a question, can U.S. companies be held responsible for harms that are not committed in the U.S.? Did you get a sense of how the justices are approaching this issue and how that statute has evolved?
So the statute, you're right, is 200 years old. And the statute is a statute that allows people to bring cases alleging a tort in violation of the laws of nations. This is a case asking the question of whether U.S. companies can be held accountable in U.S. courts for aiding and abetting child slavery, literally looking at actions that they took here in the United States. So Justice Barrett at one point asked, well, what about a corporation that is making phone calls and sending emails and making decisions and executing those decisions in a U.S. office building, but those crimes are occurring abroad? I think that's the fundamental question that the court is grappling with.
Martina, does it seem to you that the Supreme Court justices kind of feel that Nestle and Cargill should be held accountable at this point?
I was delighted to hear the skepticism expressed by all the justices who all asked the lawyer for Nestle why corporations should be outside the view of the law. As Justice Kagan asked at one point, well, if one person does something, and then if 10 people do the same thing, why does it make any difference if those 10 people then decide to form a corporation? The act is the same. And so why should there be total impunity for something just where the perpetrators have decided to organize themselves as a corporation?
How consequential would a decision be in favor of the plaintiffs, especially in the world of prosecuting child traffickers?
So this would be an enormously consequential decision. This sends a powerful, powerful message to the rest of the world that the United States is prepared to hold its own citizens accountable for violations of international law and to hold those citizens accountable in U.S. courts. You know, there were a lot of amicus briefs in this case, 18 filed on behalf of the children. And one of those briefs that was raised actually in the oral argument is a brief by foreign law practitioners who pointed out that other countries hold their corporations accountable, France, the United Kingdom. So it would be absurd for the United States to depart from that and to be the outlier in this particular area.
Martina Vandenberg is the president of the Human Trafficking Legal Center in Washington. Thanks very much for unpacking this for us.
Thank you so much.
It was in jeopardy, then it got decommissioned, and now the iconic Arecibo Radio Telescope in Puerto Rico, the world's second largest, is no more. Last night, cable suspending the 900-ton observatory platform snapped. Gravity did the rest. Astronomer Abel Mendez knew the Arecibo telescope really well. He joins us now from Vega Baja, Puerto Rico. Abel, this structure had been unstable for weeks. What was your first thought when you got the news this morning about the Arecibo Rated Telescope?
Well, it's kind of sad. We all knew that the observatory was in jeopardy, that it was not stable. So this was not unexpected. But we were hoping that eventually it will be stable enough for trying prepared for the future. But I just learned this morning, and this is definitely devastating.
I was just looking on Google Maps, and the telescope is in a densely forested part of the island in the west of Puerto Rico. When was the last time you were there, and what does the site look like lately?
Well, last time, I know that my last observation was on August 6th. It was a Thursday, I think. And the first cable fail was August 10th. We were planning to do in two more weeks another observation and train a new student, which was very excited to operate the observatory for the first time. And that is now never going to happen.
What did the scientific community lose today?
Well, there's a lot of things we lose from science and education. We have an excellent instrument to explore the universe, especially something that might impact life on Earth, is the Planetary Defense Program. That's a NASA program for detecting potentially hazardous asteroids. Mm. So we lost a lot of science we can do. We lost education. But Puerto Rico lost many more things.
Like what?
It serves as an education hub for the world. But for Puerto Ricans right here in the island, young people can go over there and get inspired. Mm. So that's my story too. I was 12 years old when I just came for the first time to the observatory. And I was inspired, and then eventually started using the observatory myself.
Wow. So you first saw this telescope when you were 12, and now you're an astronomer. This must be also a personal loss for you.
Oh, definitely. I just remember my family was always supporting me in my interests of astronomy, and they took me to the observatory. And then I was lucky that day that it was not operating. The observatory has every week has a day for maintenance. So that day was a day of maintenance. The scientists there took me below the dish. Mm. So that was an experience that no visitor, only VIPs get. And I got that when I was 12 years old.
Abel, the only thing I can say is condolences to you. It feels like a big loss.
Oh, thank you. I'm trying to recover. In the morning, I was having a hard time trying to answer questions, but now I am fine.
Abel Mendez is an astronomer at the University of Puerto Rico. He worked for many years on the Arecibo telescope, which collapsed overnight. Abel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. A reminder to our listeners, The World is free for anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. It's always been our goal to bring you human-centered journalism that connects you with people and events beyond our borders. During this holiday season, when many of us can't meet in person, that human connection is more important than ever. Help us keep the show available to everybody across the globe with your gift of $100 or more. That's just $8.33 a month. You can make your donation at theworld.org/give. When we reach our goal, you'll get an invite to a virtual party with all the incredible people who make this show possible. If you've considered donating but haven't actually done it yet, then today is the day to take intention and turn it into action, one we at the show will be deeply grateful for. Just head to theworld.org/give. Thank you. Georgia holds a key to the U.S. Senate. Organizers are trying to get Latinos there to vote Democrat. It is a challenge.
I think finding Latinos has been a hurdle already. For years and years and years, people have not invested in reaching our community.
Activists tell us why Georgia is on their minds. That's coming up just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. We don't know exactly where the new coronavirus came from. One theory, it went from bats to another animal to people. The missing link could be the pangolin. The scaly anteater is popular among smugglers. As The World's Patrick Nguyen reports from Bangkok, the dark trade could be a time bomb for the next pandemic.
If you've never seen a pangolin, picture an anteater about the size of a cat with a long pink tongue. And they're covered in armor, thick brown scales that look like tree bark. They look like they would make some cute squeaky noise, but pangolins don't really make any sound at all. Well, unless they're splashing in the mud, which they really like to do.
They're just really amazing to watch. Yeah, they're adorable animals, really, and totally harmless.
Steve Gouster helps run Freeland, a nonprofit that tries to stop traffickers of people and animals. They've got offices in Kenya, India, and Thailand. And they've seen a lot of pangolins because pangolins are the most trafficked animal in the world. They hang out in trees in warm places, sub-Saharan Africa, India, Southeast Asia, and catching them is easy, Gouster says.
Going out, usually with dogs, sometimes alone, smoking or shaking trees to get the pangolins to drop.
When surrounded, they won't bite or claw or even stick out their tongues.
Poor pangolin. Its only defense against people or anything is to crawl up into a ball.
Poachers in India, filming themselves hacking down a tree to catch a pangolin. The animal is valuable for their meat and because people think their scales can cure diseases, though that's not true. Generally speaking, it's illegal to capture pangolins and move them from country to country. But that's what happens. Trucks full of live pangolins, usually driven from their tropical homeland all the way to China, the biggest wildlife market on Earth. And along the way, Gouster says, pangolins only get fed sporadically.
They would put a hose in the pangolin's mouth, and they would even feed it some, like, we call it mealy meal. So there'd be a little bit of a starchy subject in the water, hydrating them, keep them alive.
Alive, but just barely. So they get weak and sick with whatever microbes they pick up in transit. Then they're often kept in a hot, damp warehouse with all these other trafficked animals. Here's Thai Van Nguyen with Save Vietnam's Wildlife.
It's not just pangolin, it may be many other wildlife.
Nguyen helps run one of the top pangolin rescue operations in the world. He's rescued them from warehouses, jam-packed with animals that would never interact in the wild. Turtles and sugar gliders and pangolins breathing all over each other. And the pangolin, alien as it looks, is a mammal, so it can easily give viruses to us. Steve Gouster says these warehouses or markets are just breeding grounds for viruses, with all these animals
coughing, peeing, pooping, all kinds of things that can help spread whatever they're holding on to. That's why I'm saying these are time bombs.
But is this how COVID-19 really started? Earlier this year, a Chinese study said the evidence showing the virus jumped from pangolins to people was strong. Newer research suggests maybe not. Either way, COVID-19, that's already here. But if this pangolin trade continues, it could spawn another pandemic. On that front, at least, there is good news. Chinese officials this year announced a new crackdown on the wildlife trade, putting pangolins in its most protected category. That's great, but here's some bad news. It comes courtesy of a former Thai anti-narcotics officer, Pecherat Sengchai, who in a recent speech compared animal traffickers to drug traffickers.
It's almost the same. I confirm that it is almost the same. Every activities, every supply chains and everything, they're almost the same.
The same routes, the same tricks for slipping across borders, it's the same, whether smuggling pangolins or cocaine. You can see why this is bad. There's been a crackdown on drugs for ages, and they get past police all the time. Steve Gouster from Freeland says it is often the same groups, moving meth today and wildlife tomorrow.
These are criminal syndicates. These are organized crooks who know exactly what they're doing, and they don't care about anything except how much money they're making.
Because wildlife trafficking is so globalized, it's also kind of like climate change, a problem that requires a global response.
The United States was the leader on wildlife conservation for a while. It's not right now. There is no leader in the world on wildlife conservation. If anything, we need to see China and the United States team up. Those are the two biggest consumers of wildlife in the world.
Yep, there is a ton of wildlife crime in America, too. So here's the deal. We know pandemics and wildlife are linked. We know HIV came from primates, that SARS came from a civet cat, Ebola, probably bats, COVID-19, not yet clear. But Gouster says we can all see the pattern and what needs to be done.
Perhaps the pangolin has woken us up, and maybe this is Mother Nature's revenge. You know, it might be reminding people that you mess with Mother Nature, it's going to mess with you.
For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
All eyes are on Georgia, and this being The World, I'm talking here about the state of Georgia, not the nation. In a January special runoff election, voters in Georgia will determine if the Democrats or the Republicans control the U.S. Senate. Grassroots organizations are out mobilizing every vote they can muster, including a crucial campaign targeting Latino voters. Recently, the national organization Mi Gente started canvassing in Georgia with a rally.
Georgia!
Tanya Unzueta joins me now from Atlanta. She's Mi Gente's political director. Great to have you with us, Tanya. The chanting we heard from that recent rally sounded like a sizable crowd. I know you began a campaign knocking on doors, talking to potential voters. Who exactly are the people you've reached so far, and are they first-time voters?
We have a goal of reaching every Latino voter in the state of Georgia on the doors. And that means having conversations with people in very diverse ways, given that the Latino community is not monolithic. But so we're reaching first-time voters because people can still register to vote. But we're also talking to people who voted and didn't know that there was an election coming or don't know who the candidates are, as well as people who voted Republican and were trying to convince to vote Democrat this election.
Mi Gente changed to become a partisan organization. You threw your muscle behind the Democrats. Why was it important to take that position, and when did you do that?
We are not known to be like an organization that's always in support of the Democratic Party. I think, in fact, like our history comes very much from pushing the Obama administration to shift its policies on immigration enforcement. And so like we've been there. But I think because of that, like what we've all seen under the Trump administration, like it was absolutely clear that our communities would be better off with Trump out of power. And that means our community should vote for Democrats. And it's the same thing here in the Senate. We're talking about not just what these particular individuals can do, but really a balance of power that gives us a better possibility to win on the issues that we want to win in.
So in the next few days, volunteers from across the country will be arriving in Georgia to help with these get out the vote efforts. What's going to be the biggest hurdle as you continue trying to reach Latinos?
I think finding Latinos has been a hurdle already. The data about our community is actually just really bad because for years and years and years, like people have not invested in reaching our community. And people are also moving around the state constantly because of the type of work and because of the industry that people are involved in.
Well, again, we saw this year that Latinos are not a monolith when it comes to voting. Cuban Americans in Miami are very different than Mexican Americans in Los Angeles, for example. When it comes to Georgia, what are some of the backgrounds of Latinos in Georgia and historically, how they voted?
A large number of Latinos in Georgia are of Mexican descent. You have a population that really grew after the 1996 Olympics, or like actually right before the 96 Olympics. And so these are folks who came to work in the state of Georgia and whose children now are 21 to 24, 25 years old. So if you can imagine, there's also a very growing second generation of Latinos who's coming of age in terms of being able to vote. And I think is really looking for representation in Georgia, both in politics and in their communities. There's also a growing Puerto Rican community, particularly, well, you know, folks have been here for a long time, but it grew after Hurricane Maria. And so we have folks who are coming in. And we do have like pockets of Venezuelan communities and Central American communities throughout the state. And again, as you said, they are very different in terms of where they're coming from, in terms of their understanding about Georgia politics and Democrats.
So the campaign, your campaign in Georgia is now rolling. What reactions are you hearing from different Latino communities, given what's at stake with the outcome in Georgia?
You know, so far, the reaction of those who know about the election has been good. I think a lot of people have been encouraged by the result of the general election and Georgia turning blue. I think that that's something that people have been working for a long time. Honestly, there's just still a lot of information to be given to people. There's a lot of questions about, given the way that the state of Georgia has taken voters off the registration files and like the hard time that people have had in actually being able to vote. So there's questions about just what is this runoff election? Who are the people who are running? And also, what do I need to make sure that my vote is counted in the state of Georgia.
Tanya Unzueta is the political director of Mi Gente, a national organization that's trying to get out the Latino vote for January's special Senate runoff election in the state of Georgia. Tanya, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Alejandro Mayorkas is President-elect Biden's nominee to lead the Department of Homeland Security. If confirmed, Mayorkas would be the first immigrant and the first Latino to be DHS secretary.
My father and mother brought me to this country to escape communism. They cherished our democracy and were intensely proud to become United States citizens.
That's Mayorkas speaking during the announcement event about emigrating from Cuba as a child. In the Obama administration, he served as Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security. Our next guest worked closely with Mayorkas on immigration issues when Mayorkas was in that role. Leon Fresco is an immigration attorney and served in the Office of the Attorney General, also under Obama. Leon Fresco, thanks for being here. Do you have a kind of example or personal anecdote that can give us just some insight into who Mayorkas is, his style, or just his approach to public service? Who is he?
Sure, absolutely. Ali Mayorkas is one of the most humble, gracious public servants you can examine or ever see in the public sector. And so from day one, when he started at the agency, to 6 months in, he was already the biggest code head you could imagine. And by code head, I mean the Immigration and Nationality Act, the legal code. He had that thing memorized in 6 months and was talking like he had been doing immigration law his entire life. And so then when it came time to do the DACA program, which was the program whereby 700,000-800,000 people needed to go through immigration and to actually ask for their status to be changed, at that moment, people thought, well, he's not going to be able to pull this off. I mean, there's something along the line of 1 million cases a year, period, for the agency. How's he going to double that? And the fact that that ran incredibly smoothly is probably why he's getting this nomination today.
Well, let me ask you about DACA since we're there. The Trump administration tried to end deferred action for childhood arrivals. So what do you think will happen with DACA as this new administration comes into office?
Well, so there's going to be three different things that you need to look out for. So first would be just the undoing of the plans to eliminate DACA. And that will happen pretty much on day one. The second question is, can new people apply for the program? And I think you're going to see that relatively quickly also. Then there's a third question is, the old DACA program said you had to be here since 2007. So there's been a whole new crop of dreamers that have sort of come into fray there. And the question is that going to be expanded to include that group?
So DACA is just one example of the Trump administration drastically changing how immigration works in the U.S. What do you think the Biden administration and specifically Mayorkas should prioritize on day one in office?
Well, I think the first thing you're going to see in addition to DACA is the elimination of what I would call country-based immigration bans. And then there's going to be the longer work of what you do about the asylum program, because while what's been done to the asylum program under President Trump hasn't comported with the Democratic Party's values, that's certainly true. You do run a practical problem that if you sort of undo all of that very quickly, you could risk a border surge during the COVID crisis.
So as to the idea of border protection, that was a top priority for Trump. It's been so since 2016. Do you think the same approach will continue with the Biden administration and with Mayorkas?
I don't think there will be a de-emphasis on border security if by border security we mean, are we now amenable to people crossing the border unlawfully? No, that will not be happening under a Mayorkas administration or anyone else, because we want people using proper pathways to enter the country. Now, if someone's seeking asylum, I think you'll see a change in the way they will be treated and they will be given the opportunity to seek asylum. But that's a different story than whether the border will be open.
As I said earlier, Leon, Mayorkas would be the first immigrant to serve as DHS secretary. What about that background? An immigrant, a Cuban American? How do you think that will affect the way he does his job if he's confirmed?
I think that's always very helpful to have gone through the process yourself, to have a personal identification with that process. And it gives you currency in both directions. One, sometimes you're going to need to be tough. So when he needs to be tough, he can be tough. but also he will understand that there are limits to the extent of what the government should ever be doing to someone going through this process. And that's helpful, as opposed to, you know, if you had someone who hadn't been through it, then you'd never associate how much hardship you're causing on people by certain policy.
Immigration attorney Leon Fresco worked closely during the Obama administration with Alejandro Mayorkas, Joe Biden's nominee to lead the Department of Homeland Security. Leon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Every day you rely on the world to get to the bottom of every story. We're on the clock for you, and you really ought to meet some of my amazing colleagues who make this show happen. Head over to theworld.org/whoweare. Relief today among fans of the mega-famous South Korean boy band BTS. The seven lads in the group can postpone their mandatory military service and keep on cranking out hits like this. The Korea Herald reports today that the National Assembly in Seoul passed a bill. Yes, the Korean legislature allotted time for a BTS discussion. And the bill lets the K-pop superstars defer their military service to age 30. That exemption has been available to elite athletes and classical musicians and now aging boy bands. It's also a nod to the belief that BTS are in service to South Korea by raising the prestige of the nation. Well, if pop chart rankings can do that, then this track, Life Goes On, from BTS's latest album, should do wonders for Korea's profile. Life Goes On debuted this week at number one on the Billboard Hot 100. There are still conflicting reports about the details, but this is what is clear. An Iranian nuclear scientist was killed in Tehran last Friday, Mohsen Farinejad. We also know that he was with his wife when he died. She now joins a group of widows and mothers of assassinated Iranian nuclear scientists. Here is the world's Shirin Jafari with more.
Shortly after Mohsen Farinejad was killed, his wife was on national TV. She wore a traditional black chador, the outfit of the conservative women in Iran, and a face mask. I want to congratulate the 12th Imam and the Supreme Leader, she says, referring to the Shia religious figure and Iran's top political leader. I want to congratulate all the people of Iran for this martyrdom. My husband was a scientist, but he was also a caring and loving partner, she said. Viewers never got to learn the name of the scientist's wife. She was only introduced as the wife of Mohsen Fakhrinejad. Maybe this was at her own request. Some deeply conservative women in Iran prefer not to use their names in public. But in any case, the interview was the latest episode in a series of what seems to have become a genre on Iranian television, the eulogy of the widow or the mother of a slain nuclear scientist, or as some call them, martyrs. In the past decade, at least five nuclear scientists have been killed in Iran. One survived with injuries. Often, it's only after their deaths that Iranians learned about these experts, says Nazila Fathi. She's a fellow with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and a former reporter in Iran.
They were completely unknown figures to us until they were assassinated and we heard their stories. And then little by little, we heard about their family members and their wives.
Fatih says this isn't entirely new. There's a long tradition of TV interviews like these.
Whether the martyrs were men who were killed during the war with Iraq or during the revolution or, I mean, in an incident or something.
They were usually wrapped in the black head-to-toe covering, she says. Their faces barely visible.
And their voices were the voices of these traditional women who always echoed the party line.
Devout women who would sacrifice anything for the nation and the supreme leader, including their sons or husbands. But today, Fatih says, some of these women no longer fit the traditional mold.
Darush.
Shohreh Pirani's husband was killed 9 years ago. Dariush Rezai Nejad was a physicist. He was shot dead near the family's home in Tehran. Pirani herself was injured in the attack, and their four-year-old daughter witnessed the whole thing. In this interview from 3 years ago, Pirani describes how the couple met for the first time. They were both students, she said. She was studying political science. He was an electrical engineering student. Initially, I was taken aback at how young he looked, she said. He had a real baby face. In another part of the interview, Pirani tells the story of how they picked out their wedding rings. It was tough, she says, because none of them would fit. Reza Inejad joked at the time that his fingers were too fat. Nazila Fatihi with the Middle East Institute says Pirani is different because she also posts on Instagram, where she has about 100,000 followers.
These are posts of a young woman, a young wife, a young mother who writes how much she misses her husband. She posts pictures of her husband when they were at a beach, showing this very young man who now we know was a very prominent nuclear scientist.
Fatih says the Iranian government views these personal stories as politically beneficial. They help deflect from the government's security failures and they galvanize support against the enemies of Iran. But they also open a window into the lives of these women. So far, no group or country has officially claimed responsibility for the assassinations of the Iranian scientists. Iran blames Israel. Meanwhile, Iranian scientists and their families wonder who might be next. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
These days, the idea of getting on an airplane feels, at the very least, weird. So how about an appreciation of flying through music? Composer and conductor Christopher Tin pulled together themes and passions about flight through history in a work called To Shiver the Sky. Here's Christopher to tell us more about his latest soaring work.
It's an oratorio in 11 movements about the history of aviation, and it's told using the words of the great pilots, inventors, engineers, poets, and storytellers that actually pushed this narrative forward across the centuries. Everyone from Da Vinci to Amelia Earhart to Ferdinand von Zeppelin to Jules Verne to Nicholas Copernicus to Yuri Gagarin. It tells the entire breadth of the story. The song that you're listening to now is called Sogno di Volare, which roughly translates to The Dream of Flight. It's sung in Italian by the Royal Opera Chorus of Covent Garden, London. And this is a setting of Leonardo da Vinci's quote, "For once you have flown, you will always look at the sky, for that is your home, and that is where you long to return." This piece serves as the central motif for the entire oratorio. Every time mankind hits failure or catastrophic destruction, as is often the case in the quest for flight, the dream of flight theme comes back and sort of summons us back to the cockpit. It gets us back on our feet and reminds us that we need to keep pushing forward to achieve our vision of being amongst the stars. It's sort of ironic in a way to be releasing an album about flight during a time when very few of us can actually travel due to the pandemic. But it was nice to sort of make something that was a reminder that there was a sort of a golden age of belief in ourselves. The final movement of the album is called We Choose to Go to the Moon, and it's a setting of John F. Kennedy's monumental moon landing speech. And what I think is particularly powerful about it is that John F. Kennedy says that we are not going to make space the next frontier for war or hostility. Instead, we're going to fill space with instruments of knowledge and science and peace. And I think that's a message that we can all take home with us for this holiday season.
Composer and conductor Christopher Tin's new work is called To Shiver the Sky. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, be healthy. We'll be back with you here tomorrow.
from PRX.